Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of this channel. Today, we'll be talking to Jörg Matthias Detemann on his new book, Space Science and the Arab World, Astronauts, Observatories, and Nationalism in the Middle East. It's a fascinating history of science and space science in the Arab world, and also a prism through which to look at a whole range of issues that many people are looking at, including issues such as soft power, scientific developments, the relationship between the region and the various external hegemons, as well as issues of autocracy, open society, and of course, the impact of religion. Matthias, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, James. I would really like to thank you for all your time, for all your efforts and your services to Middle East studies. And I would also like to give a shout out to Marshall Poe and his team of the New Books Network. It's a fantastic initiative. It's a great honor, actually, for me to appear now for the third time on the New Books Network. My previous two books have also appeared in podcast discussions on the network. And I've been assigning podcasts by other people about other books also in my classes. So I've been a big fan of the New Books Network, and it is a great pleasure and privilege to speak to you again.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show, and thank you for your gracious words. Maybe we can start off with you giving us a little bit of a background on yourself, your educational development, and how you got to writing in general about history of science, but particularly about the history of space science in the Arab world.
Thank you for this question, James. To give our listeners some background of how old I am, I'm 33 now. I was born in 1984, and I grew up with science fiction. I was a big fan of Star Trek, The Next Generation, which I watched during the 1990s, as well as Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Star Trek Voyager, and of course the Star Wars movies. So before I was interested in the Middle East, I was very much interested in space, the final frontier, and in science fiction. At the time, I didn't really know that there was such a thing as the history of science, however. In addition to my interests in space, I have been interested in politics. When I was becoming an adult, I really enjoyed talking about politics. And I finished my high school in 2003 in Vienna, in Austria. And at that time, when everyone was talking about politics, global politics, world politics, the Middle East was really one of the central areas, one of the hottest topics for discussions, just as it probably still is. 2003 was, of course, the year of the American-led invasion of Iraq. It was 2 years after the September 11th attacks. So my interest in politics, interest in the Middle East, led me to study Arabic studies at the University of Vienna, as well as history. When I was studying history, I also learned that there was such a thing as the history of science. I really enjoyed about those history of science, history of technology courses in particular. That was during my undergraduate years at the University of Vienna between 2003 and 2007. And it took me a little while to find a way to combine these early interests in both the Middle East, in politics, and in space and science. But now, with this third book of mine, I was finally able to combine these interests in a project that I'm just really, really interested in and passionate about. So I'm extremely grateful that I have a job as an academic, as an assistant professor here at Virginia Commonwealth University in Qatar, where I'm based. an opportunity to follow my interests and to write this book on space science and the Arab world.
Well, you've certainly done that in a very fascinating way. I'm not a history of science buff, nor am I a space buff, but I found the book fascinating and very engaging and learned a great deal from it. What it strikes me is that there are, and you go into that in great length, and perhaps you can describe that in greater detail. What it strikes me is that the book is, on the one hand, indeed, astronomy coming home, if you wish, given the early contributions of the Muslim world to astronomy and science in general. But it's also very much a prism, an unusual prism, at looking at the contemporary Middle East with all its convulsions, and touches on a multitude of issues, including the impact on religion, the relationship between religion and politics, and how that is changing, the way Middle Eastern states try to project themselves on the international stage, soft power, the relationship and how that impacts research of in societies that are less democratic. And I could go on with all kinds of other aspects of it. But I'd like you to sort of delve into it. You also very much focused on sort of the relationship with, on the one hand, the scientist as a national, a citizen of a country, and on the other hand, as a cosmopolitan.
Right. Thank you very much, Abba, for this great question, James. Space science is interested in the Middle East because it is connected to a regional past as well as to a national and global future. Space science and astronomy are connected to the regional past through this huge heritage of Arabic and Islamic astronomy. The narrative of the golden age of Arabic and Islamic science that is powerful still in people's heads, despite historians of science having criticized such generalizing narratives as golden age or the decline that was followed. But this heritage of Arabic and Islamic science is something that people in the region here in the Middle East value very much. And a renaissance of science and a renaissance of Arab and Islamic space sciences in particular is something that people are looking to. I also mentioned that space science in the region, but not just in the region, is connected to the national future. Space exploration in general and space science are perhaps a field of activity that are perhaps uniquely tied to the future. I mentioned earlier in our conversation science fiction. So much science fiction is about space. So if you can appear as a nation as being a leader in space science, you can also appear as the nation of the future. And which ruler, which politician does not want to be the leader of the country of the future? Towards the end of your question, James, you also mentioned cosmopolitanism. That's another concept that I emphasize very much in the book. Cosmopolitanism means literally citizenship of the world. A cosmopolitan would be a citizen of the cosmos, a citizen of the world. And space science is perhaps one of the most global sciences that we have. After all, space scientists and astronomers everywhere around the globe are looking at the same skies. They're the same sky. They're looking at the same stars roughly. Of course, there's a northern hemisphere and a southern hemisphere with different stars, but roughly there is just one universe that people are looking at. And of course, space science is big science. A lot of space science is very expensive science. So very few nation states have actually the resources to do this kind of science alone. So in order to have an international space station, in order to have a big space satellite, a lot of nations had to collaborate with people from other countries. And that requires a certain commitment to internationalism and to cosmopolitanism.
It strikes me when I was reading the book that that it wasn't clear to me what the balance is. With on the one hand, the what you described as basically the cosmopolitanism of space and space research, and the national aspect of it, in other words, rulers who want to be seen as being cutting edge and indeed leaders of the future, but also in terms of the military and other applications that space research has. And in that context, it also struck me that on the one hand, it's true cosmopolitanism, but on the other hand, given the religious resistance that has always existed, particularly to space sciences, that it was also often the only way that scientists, for whom it often was about the quest of knowledge more than anything else, it was the only way that Arab scientists could stay engaged.
Very good. I have a question, a very complex question here that you're asking me. Nationalism, regionalism, cosmopolitanism, I argue, all play a role in space exploration in the Arab world. Nationalism is important in trying to convince politicians to invest the huge amounts of money that space telescopes, big observatories, space shuttles, satellites, etc., often require. So why would a politician invest millions and billions of dollars into an activity like space science, especially an activity that might not, like other sciences, for instance, promise a cure for cancer, let's say. In order for politicians to make those kinds of investments, they have to be convinced of the national importance of space science. So of the importance of a given space project for national security, for national growth, for the national economy. And indeed, a lot of space science has national security implications. A satellite with a camera can be used to study the stars, but can also be used to turn on Earth and serve as a spy satellite. A rocket can be used to launch a satellite into orbit, but it can also be used to hit an enemy country. So a lot of space science has these dual uses of civilian and military uses. And that is why many space programs have been very appealing to politicians. And that's also why some rocket programs or missile programs, such as the Iraqi one during the 1980s and 1990s, or the Iranian one during the 2000s and 2010s, have been controversial. However, even if a country wants to invest in space science, for national purposes, for purposes of strengthening national security and national capabilities, hardly any nation can do space science by itself. And historians of science have, for instance, shown how much the American space program and the Soviet space program in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s benefited from transnational expertise. For instance, from German scientists and engineers involved in the V-2 rocket program during World War II. Famously, Werner von Braun went from Nazi Germany to help develop NASA rockets in the 1950s and 1960s. So if Cold War superpowers couldn't develop space science just by themselves, developing countries of the size of many Arab countries can't do it either. So in order to launch a satellite into orbit, Arab countries have relied on launch vehicles from other countries, such as European rockets or an American space shuttle or Russian rockets and Japanese rockets more recently. I think, James, you had another question related to religion that I didn't quite answer here.
Well, let me come back to that in a different context. And that is, you spoke about the incentive for a national leader, a national politician, to engage in the kind of expenditure and effort that space research takes. It strikes me some ways, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that to some degree you also argue that in your book, that in some ways the Arab world is a little bit different from other countries. So with other words, you have, for example, in the Gulf, very wealthy nations who have long been regarded as primarily tribal, backward, and to varying degrees have over the years attempted, and some more successful than others, to change that perception. So I don't think that perception today is one of the United Arab Emirates. I think the perception of Saudi Arabia is one that is changing, where people feel that it may succeed, but the jury is out. And so in that context, and part of the perception of these countries has been, first and foremost, of course, in Saudi Arabia, the role and the power of the religious establishment, which was very critical of things like space science, and as opposed to the non-Muslim world, also much more powerful. And so the question is whether there the aspect of wanting to project being cutting edge is actually a much more urgent and much more immediate need than it would be for maybe other developing countries or other countries that that have yet to develop a space research program and other things that will project them on the international on the international map.
Very good question, James. Yes, indeed, space programs have not only been about national power, about national growth, national security. They have also been about soft power. They have been about legitimacy and about prestige. Countries across the Arab world have wanted to be seen as countries of the future. Already going back to the 1950s and 1960s, countries with governments that saw themselves as progressive, such as Gamal Abdel Nasser's government in Egypt at the time, were trying to be leaders of the Arab world and of the Third World, more broadly, and technological leadership could give a country such as Gamal Abdel Nasser's Egypt the appearance of also being a leading country to look out for. Now, you mentioned the Arab Gulf countries in particular. Aber these Arab Gulf countries had historically to struggle with a lot of stereotypes of being just desert countries, of being Bedouin places, of being backward and uneducated and unsophisticated places compared to the older centers of learning in the Arab world, such as Cairo, such as Damascus, Aleppo, Baghdad, and so on. So science and space science in particular has also been a means for the Gulf countries to no longer be seen as these backward countries, but to be seen as indeed countries of the future. And if you go especially to places like Dubai, you really see a lot of investment in that kind of image. Dubai has a museum of the future even. But Dubai has, as many of our listeners know, the highest, tallest building on earth, the Burj Khalifa, which also appears in many recent science fiction films such as Independence Day Resurgence. Now to get back to the religious aspect, Gulf countries have not only relied on science as a source of legitimacy, as a sort of technocratic source of legitimacy. At the same time, in particular, Saudi Arabia has also very much focused on its religious legitimacy. Saudi Arabia is, after all, the country of the two holy mosques, the mosques of Mecca and Medina. The House of Saud, the royal family of Saudi Arabia, has seen itself as leaders of an important Islamic reform movement, the movement that was started by Sheikh Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab in the 18th century. So Saudi Arabia, throughout the 20th century and into the 21st century, has supported Wahhabi movements, Salafi movements, and generally a very conservative Sunni current in the Arab and Muslim world and throughout the globe. The problem here, of course, is that the traditional Islamic view of the cosmos was a view that was pre-Copernican largely. So that was a view that was before Nicolaus Copernicus and his revolution in our understanding of the world. So the traditional Islamic view of the cosmos was geocentric, was a view that the earth is in the center of the universe, and then you would have various other heavenly bodies rotating around the earth. So the sun was rotating around the earth, the other planets was rotating around the earth, and at the furthest edge you would find God's throne, in Arabic, Al-Arsh. And Al-Arsh is also mentioned in the Quran. Traditionally, Saudi Arabia has supported this kind of view that the earth was at the center of the universe, that the earth was fixed, and that the other planets and the sun rotate around the earth. And that is, of course, very much at odds with the modern view of the universe, in which the sun is at the center of our solar system, and our solar system is just one of many, many solar systems in our galaxy, and our galaxy is only one galaxy out of many, many galaxies. So here you can see a tension between, on the one hand, the traditional Islamic worldview that Saudi Arabia has been promoting and Saudi Arabia's desire to gain a technocratic, a scientific, a modern, a technological legitimacy in the world.
It strikes me that, you know, you talked a great deal about the religious influence, And religion is, of course, a major determinant of culture. And the question arises whether, in some ways, the Arab world, and particularly Saudi Arabia, but other, also other parts of the Arab world, have in order to really be able to be scientifically successful, and particularly in the space sciences, whether there is not a fundamental shift in mentality and approach needed. So, with other words, if you take Israel, which is a Middle Eastern state but not a an Arab state, Israel is a state that is on the cutting edge of technology. It's a state where learning and studying and research are embedded in the culture that of Jewish culture that precedes the state of Israel, whereas the culture of the Arab world, and maybe broader of the Muslim world, was not one that was so focused on independent learning, on critical questioning, but had much more an element of rote learning. And to what degree does that, so the question is, what does that mean in terms of creating the kind of basis and the kind of approach that you need to develop science, to engage in space research?
Thank you for this question, James. Yes, but the Arab world is facing huge challenges. And here we're not just talking about the poorer Arab countries or the conflict-ridden Arab countries. So I'm not just talking about countries such as Libya, such as Yemen, such as Syria, such as Iraq, that have huge problems at the moment, huge challenges relating to civil wars, international wars, etc. Also, the richer Arab countries, the Gulf monarchies in particular, have big challenges and big ambitions. And one of the big challenges and ambitions of these Arab Gulf countries is to get away from an oil-based or oil-driven economy, getting closer towards a knowledge economy or a knowledge-based economy. Countries such as Qatar or Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates, in their national visions, are trying to get to an economy where these countries are able to sell knowledge, so sell patents, sell drugs, sell high technology, and not just raw materials such as oil and gas. These countries also hope that these new high-tech industries would be able to absorb many educated but underemployed or underemployed young Arabs in the region. So a tech industry, a high-tech industry, a science industry is something that Arab leaders have been coveting. You are right, however, that this perhaps requires a revolution in many different ways, in different spheres. You mentioned rote learning. More student-centered, more active learning parts of education should be pushed. I should also mention here that perhaps science fiction as a sphere of cultural activity that has been growing in the Arab world should probably also receive more support. So whereas in the United Kingdom and in the United States, we have major science fiction awards by the names of Hugo and Nebula, such awards don't yet exist for Middle Eastern literature. So we need probably more programs like that that could encourage and stimulate Arab creativity. You mentioned Israel. Israel has a very sophisticated military, industrial, scientific complex. So a complex where Israeli defense manufacturers are collaborating with academic institutions such as state universities, are collaborating with state funding bodies. And in order to have a sophisticated space industry, probably a similar connection between industry, between the state, and between universities and research institutes would need to be established in the Arab world. Oil producing countries in the Arab world have often relied on so-called turnkey projects. So a project where an Arab country would commission, let's say, a telescope, and this telescope would then be delivered by a Western company. Or Arab countries have imported a lot of weapons, missile defense systems, airplanes, and so on. And these kind of weapons and equipment would often be manufactured outside of the region and then shipped almost ready to be used in the region. And I think if Arab countries are serious about building a space industry in their own countries, they would also need to grow space high-tech manufacturing businesses. So rather than just buying Chinese or Russian or European or American rockets and missiles, Arab countries would probably need to find ways to manufacture this kind of high-tech equipment in the region, just like Israel has done to a certain extent.
I mean, you're seeing some degree of moves towards building a domestic knowledge base, of domestic production base, of achieving degrees of self-sufficiency in various sectors, particularly with regard to military acquisitions. So a lot more offset arrangements. The Chinese building a drone factory in Saudi Arabia. As you were doing research on your book, do you see any of that starting to happen in the space environment?
Right. So in the scientific arena in general, there have been attempts to establish science and technology parks. So institutions that could serve as interface between industry, national funding bodies, and academia. And for instance, Qatar has the Qatar Science and Technology Park, funded by Qatar Foundation, an institution that links different universities in Qatar with the private sector, with funding bodies like the Qatar National Research Fund. We've also seen in Saudi Arabia over the decades of institutions that have been trying to be an interface between these different sectors. Saudi Arabia is currently in the process of building NEOM, a high-tech city, but there have been previous high-tech cities such as Jubail and Yanbu, or such as the King Abdulaziz City for Science and Technology in Saudi Arabia that has been active since around 1980. However, in terms of space science in particular, perhaps the most ambitious country or one of the most ambitious countries in the world has been the United Arab Emirates. The United Arab Emirates has made important investments in the global private space industry, in particular in the company of Virgin Galactic of Richard Branson. The United Arab Emirates has also been very active in number of ambitious projects related to Mars, in particular these Emirates Mars mission that is supposed to be launched in 2020, coinciding with the Dubai Expo. An orbiter that is supposed to study the Martian atmosphere is supposed to reach that planet in 2021, coinciding with the 50th anniversary of the United Arab Emirates. And this project is not just a turnkey project. This is not just a project of buying a foreign satellite and launching it from a foreign rocket. This project seeks to include Arab, and in particular Emirati scientists and engineers, as much as possible. Obviously, the United Arab Emirates is not able to do that just by itself. So the UAE has relied extensively on collaborations with South Korea, with Japan, and with the United States of America. However, capacity building in Dubai and in Abu Dhabi, in the UAE Space Agency, and in the Mohammed bin Rashid Space Center, an institution in Dubai, has been central to the Emirati Mars exploration efforts.
I mean, you know this as an academic, as a scholar, as a researcher. A lot of research is very focused, but a lot of research is also very creative, and you don't know where it's going to take you ultimately. You know, you're dealing, particularly again in the Gulf, with regimes whose raison d'etre is to ensure their survival. And part of their survival strategy is indeed economic reform, social reform, and taking their countries into the 21st century, something that the UAE certainly has done on many levels. On the other hand, I get the impression that there's also a very utilitarian approach to scientific and particularly space scientific development, in that it's designed not simply to produce knowledge, but it's designed to serve the purpose that the regimes need, whether that's military, whether that's civilian applications, whether that's economic applications.
This would be true also for other Arab countries. Not just for other Arab countries, but for countries around the world. So the initial investments in space and rocket science, in particular during the early Cold War, by the United States, for instance, and by the Soviet Union, were connected to our building intercontinental ballistic missiles, for instance. So utilitarian purposes have been part of space programs throughout the world. This is nothing special. So science has hardly been ever perhaps been produced just for pure knowledge's sake, right? Even when funding bodies in Europe or in North America decide to fund one particular project over another project, they're not just looking at the pure knowledge outcomes in many cases, but also in, for instance, the economic promises of a specific research effort. Or funding bodies would look at the benefits to national security of a specific funding application, and so on. You are right that perhaps Arab countries have not done enough to support creativity for its own sake and knowledge for its own sake. However, I'm actually more positive than that, and I can see many, many successful initiatives to invest, for instance, in the arts and in the creative fields. In Qatar, where I live, the government has made significant investments in art museums, for instance. I would also say that creativity does not always require a democracy. And you can have, within certain constraints, obviously, free thinking, even in authoritarian countries. And for instance, we've seen a lot of art that has come out of the Syrian revolution since 2011. I should also say that the Soviet Union was not a democracy. At the same time, the Soviet Union did contribute hugely to space exploration, to our knowledge of the moon, to our knowledge of the universe. And there have been very, very important and influential Soviet science fiction authors. So even if Arab countries have not, perhaps not done enough to promote free thinking, to promote creativity for its own sake and promote knowledge production for its own sake, these activities have still happened, even in countries like Syria, that have been very repressive.
It's one of the things that strikes me is that you've seen over the last decade, perhaps most in the UAE, and post 2011, the era of revolts, a huge spike, again, more in the Gulf than elsewhere, of investment in space sciences, the recent billion-dollar investment that the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, made into Richard Branson's various space enterprises, with an option to invest another almost $500 million, possibly. And the question there is whether or not that's also related to, and what your research showed on this, whether that's also not related to changing attitudes. So, with other words, certainly up until the era of Barack Obama in the United States, the fundamental defense and security premise in the Gulf was the protection by a hegemon, the hegemon being the United States. And with the rise of Obama, his lack or less interest, or seeing less national interest, U.S. national interest in the Middle East, is focus or wanting to focus much more on Asia than on the Middle East, and therefore the Gulf states becoming more assertive in their policies. Whether that is part of the explanation why now, in the last years, space science has taken on such a greater importance.
That's a very good interpretation. Space industry, the high-tech sector more broadly, promises to provide jobs for young people in the Arab world. And of course, with rising population numbers, this has become a more urgent need. However, you're absolutely right that Gulf Arab countries can no longer rely on outsourcing their national security. We certainly now live in a multipolar world where the United States of America is still extremely powerful with military bases around the world, but where we've also seen the rise of China, certainly over the last decades. In the Middle East in particular, we've also perhaps seen a comeback of Russia, that Russia is still, or perhaps again, a very, very important actor with big stakes in Syria in particular. In some ways, it has seemed that Russia has been actually a more skilled diplomatic actor in the Middle East. So whereas the United States, for instance, would not officially talk with certain parties, perhaps the Syrian regime, perhaps members of the Iranian government, and so on. Russia has been quite successful at talking with a variety of actors, with talking with the Assad government, with Erdogan's government in Turkey, with Qatar, with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, and so on. So there is a multipolarity even in the Middle East. Countries such as the United Arab Emirates can't just hope that by just relying solely on one superpower like the United States, all of their main problems would be solved. So I think developing a domestic military-industrial complex, developing a domestic manufacturing industry, including an arms manufacturing industry, but developing local satellites that could be used for space exploration, but satellites that can also be used for remote sensing or looking at Earth from space, monitoring things and activities on the ground from above. All of these projects to develop a high-tech field, a space industries field, I think has been in part connected to the feeling that the United Arab Emirates or Saudi Arabia has to do more to guarantee its survival than just to cultivate a good relationship with the White House.
I want to touch on an aspect that we've implicitly touched on a little bit, but not really explicitly, and that is, in a sense, the relationship of science, including space science, and identity. So for the longest period of time in the Arab world, nationalism, regional identities, but also religious identity were the main pillars of identity. And the question is, as you go towards a knowledge-based society, a cutting-edge 21st century society as your goal, to what degree science is becoming or should become part of that national identity or national ethos, if you wish?
I think, so the question, James, was about to what extent national identity should become part of a national ethos.
No, the question was basically, as you move from societies in which nationalism, various other ethnic or sub-ethnic identities, and religion are the main components of identity, that as you move towards societies that are much more geared towards knowledge, much more geared towards the cutting edge in a fast-changing world, whether the notion of science, of space research, of all of those things that go with it, needs to become part of that national identity.
Absolutely. And I think it is actually inevitable. Space plays an ever important role in not just the lives of elites, but also the lives of common people. Satellite television is ubiquitous. Satellites through, for instance, the global positioning system or GPS plays a huge role, for instance, in people's use of mobile phones and other kinds of devices. The use of Uber, for instance, is very important in countries like Qatar because the public transport system is not yet as developed as in major metropolises of Europe or in North America. Saudi Arabia has even invested significant amounts of money in Uber. Through mobile apps that rely on GPS, satellites, again, play a very important role in people's lives. Obviously, observing Earth from space is very important for addressing major challenges of the world, such as global climate change. So space is becoming ever more important. It seems science fiction as an area is are becoming hugely important, not just perhaps in the country where modern science fiction originated, especially Western Europe, Europe in general, and North America, but we see science fiction on the rise, for instance, in China, but we also see more and more science fiction authors in the Arab world. So I think with space becoming more and more important in the imagination of people, as well as in actual lives of people, I feel it is inevitable that space activities, space exploration will be connected to national identity, national ethos, etc.
I'm afraid that we're slowly getting to the end of this interview, but before we conclude, where does this project take you from here, and what do you do next?
I already mentioned quite a lot, actually, in our conversation, science fiction. So my next book's project is having the title, working title, Islam and Extraterrestrial Life, Astrobiology and Science Fiction in the Muslim World. So I'm interested in how Muslims have imagined life elsewhere in the universe, the ultimate other, if you will. So I'm studying Muslim astronomers, how they've thought about life elsewhere in the universe. I'm studying also more traditionally educated Islamic scholars, what they say about the connection between Islam and extraterrestrial life. There are various questions that are actually quite interesting to look at. For instance, what would Islam on another planet look like? How do you fast on another planet? Do you fast according to sunrise and sunset on that planet or to our planet? If you have a human colony on Mars or in another solar system or in another galaxy, would they still have to do the pilgrimage to Mecca, for instance, as part of their duties? Then, of course, there are questions like, if God, and if you believe that God created rational, intelligent beings on other planets, do you then also believe that God would have sent a divine message of revelation to those planets? Does that mean perhaps if you believe that a divine revelation came to Muhammad here on this planet, that there would be a similar Muhammad-like figure on other planets? So I'm looking at traditionally Islamic scholars and how they have dealt with those questions. And I'm also interested in science fiction authors, in science fiction filmmakers across the Muslim world. I'm very, very fortunate in that I have some student research assistants with excellent language skills that I don't have. So I have a student assistant who, for instance, analyzes Turkish science fiction movies for me. I have another student assistant who reads Bengali science fiction novels. And I have another student assistant who works on Urdu material. So I'm really delving into the strangest, weirdest fantasies that Muslims have had over the last 100, 200 years. So imaginations of life of all kinds in this solar system and another solar system. Perhaps you can hear from my voice that I'm quite passionate about this project. And it is really a lot of fun. Studying this material that is relatively unknown, I should say, outside their respective countries. So whereas we know a lot of Egyptian literature in general, right? Many people are aware, for instance, of the Egyptian Nobel Prize winner, Naguib Mahfouz. This knowledge of Egyptian literature is often more confined to elite literature, to social realism in particular, and very little Arabic science fiction or Urdu science fiction or Turkish science fiction or Persian science fiction has been translated into other languages, or rarely has, let's say, a Turkish science fiction author or an Egyptian science fiction author been discussed in academic departments of literature at Western universities. So I feel that there's a big gap of knowledge on that area. I'm not the only person, obviously, who is working on, let's say, Arabic science fiction. Fortunately, there has been increasing interest also among other academics. Whereas we do have, for instance, books about the history of the extraterrestrial life debate in the West, but we don't really have one yet about the history of the extraterrestrial life debate and all the imaginations that come with it in the Muslim world. So that's my current project after space science and the Arab world is out now.
Absolutely fascinating. One last question. Does that take you into different concepts of life after death? Obviously, Islam has a very different concept of what life after death is. In fact, that's what Muslims, at least in theory, strive for, as opposed to other Abrahamic religions.
Very good question. One imagination, well, that is actually shared in the Muslim world with other Abrahamic religion is, of course, the notion of paradise, that one would enter this beautiful utopian space. And of course, a lot of science fiction has dealt with either utopias or dystopias. So ideal societies are paradise-like societies or the opposite on different planets or far into the future. I'm also thinking that perhaps science fiction has allowed Arab authors, Muslim authors, authors perhaps in general who have lived with censorship to express perhaps criticism of our conditions in their own societies by situating notions of an ideal society in their mind in the future, or by situating such notions of a paradise-like society on other planets.
I'm afraid that all that's left to me, this was a fascinating discussion from which I learned a lot, and hopefully our listeners will learn a lot, but all that's left to me is to thank you for being so generous with your time and say goodbye and best of luck.
I would like to thank you as well. I should say that I'm not just a big fan of the New Books Network, but also I've been a great follower of your own Middle East soccer blog and related research. So it has been a real privilege and pleasure to talk with you, James. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthias.